hope you can make it back next Thursday night at 6 for lots more great singer-songwriters and folk music here on CFRC. And coming up next is Things I Will Keep, so stick around for an eclectic mix of indie music just in a few minutes. Take care, everybody. See you next week. Have a great weekend coming up.
See the pyramids around the Nile. Watch the sunrise from a tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while, you belong to me. See the marketplace in old Algiers. Send me photographs and souvenirs. Just remember, when a dream appears, you belong to me.
Hi, I'm Brittany.
Hi, I'm Helena.
And we're Nice on the Band.
And you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will be covering a variety of news related to Palestine from various countries around the world. We will start with South Africa. The country gained respect for its open criticism of the genocidal war undertaken by the Israeli government against Palestinians. But what about white South Africans? Are they participating in the protests? And why some South African activists are accusing their government of hypocrisy? Then we will move to Canada and talk about our own government pattern when it comes to genocide. Is the inaction of Canada on Palestine an exception, or does Canada have a history of uselessness when it comes to these types of atrocities? After, we will hear from Israelis themselves. Recently, 3,000 of them signed an open letter asking the international community to stop their government and impose a ceasefire. Then we will move on to Australia and see how the latest activism by pro-apartheid groups is trying to suppress academic freedom in the country, and see what is the reason for this latest escalation and panic by these pro-apartheid groups over student activism. We'll move on next to the Arab world. First, we will cover the latest news about the invasion of Lebanon and the empty promises of France's government to Lebanese. And finally, we will look into the relation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Are there signs of rapprochement between them? One article seems to think so. So as you see, we have a lot to cover today. Stay tuned. The first article we're going to look into is from the Middle East Eye, written by Azad Issa, titled, Why So Many White South Africans Are Reluctant to Support Palestine. The article starts by saying, between the placards and the slogans, the keffiyehs and the Palestinian flags at the protest, and behind the graffiti around the Bokap neighborhood in Cape Town, and beyond South Africa's case at the ICJ, observers and activists say the optics unveil an open secret. Only a handful of white South Africans have come on board to express support for Palestine. Activists say the community, who benefited from apartheid rule in South Africa for several decades, have either demonstrated an indifference to the war on the Palestinians or employed a roaring endorsement of Israel's quote, right to self-defense. Doug Falconer, a protester in Cape Town, says, and I'm quoting, "It's disappointing that so few white people are interested. It's unfortunate. They should have learned from our history." I think it's logical. South Africa is still a settler colonial country. White people are still settlers in this country and naturally see themselves as Jewish Israelis rather than as the Palestinians. The economy is the real center of power, and white people still control the economy. Things have changed politically, but not economically. The article continues to explain, white South Africans make up 7% of the country and own much of the country's commercial land. They also dominate the upper echelons of corporate structures. In 2022, South Africa's Commission for Employment Equity found that white South Africans occupied 65.9% of top management level posts. Black people occupied just 13.8%. The article also talked about the, quote, besieged mentality. And it says, despite the economic indicators suggesting otherwise, white South Africans continue to grasp false narratives of being subject to a, quote, white genocide in the country. Doug Falconer, the activist, explains, quote, many white people see themselves as besieged and protecting what they see as rightfully theirs. This besieged mentality has culminated in white farmers recruiting former Israeli army commandos to train them against government-proposed land redistribution policies. Jada, another activist whose parents were in a mixed-race relationship during apartheid, says that she was a little hesitant to beat down on all white South Africans, given that she personally knew several who opposed apartheid and Zionism. However, she noted that the white community could be more involved given their size and influence in the country. She goes on and says, and I'm quoting, I think there could have been a bigger presence from white people, but I also think there could be more black people here too. Another activist, Sherry Edendorf, who is a volunteer with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, she says, and I'm quoting, most white South Africans I speak to about this are mostly oblivious as to the scale of the ongoing genocide, or simply repeat uninformed Israeli and Western talking points, unquote. Now, it's important to remember this ignorance of Israeli apartheid is particularly bizarre in the context of South Africa, considering that as early as 1961, South African's Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd, who is considered the architect of apartheid, compared South Africa's system of racial segregation to Israel's policy toward the Palestinians. He said, quote, Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was back in 1961. Another activist, Ronnie Casserils, they say, and I'm quoting, we do note there is growing concern by many amongst them, but not to the extent that they are prepared to join in the protests. The article continues to explain, Casserils' observation is corroborated by other organizers and observers who note a slight increase in the number of white South Africans participating in expressed solidarity actions for Palestine over the past year, but add there is a hesitation over the fear of reprisals, including the threat of losing a job, being socially isolated, or being charged with anti-Semitism. It continues to explain, just as the mainstream Zionist organizations are known to weaponize anti-Semitism in the United States, organizations defending Israel in South Africa have sought to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. The article talks about an example of this, an example at the beginning of the year, when South Africa took Israel to the ICJ, The South African Jewish Board for Deputies described South Africa's effort at the ICJ as anti-Semitic. What's interesting for us here in Canada is that this organization referenced the Minister of Justice of Canada when they made their points, and they said, and I'm quoting, in the words of former Minister of Justice of Canada and human rights activist Erwin Kotler, South Africa is inverting reality by accusing Israel of genocide. The fact that South Africa has brought into this inversion to the extent that it has taken Israel to the International Court of Justice can only be interpreted as anti-Semitic. Unquote. Before I continue with the Middle East Eye article, The Mail and Guardian just reported that South Africa has provided forensic proof to the International Court of Justice that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The country has filed papers setting out its full case before the court. Evidence set out over more than 150 pages in the memorial filed on Monday will provide further forensic proof of intent to commit genocide in Gaza. Annexes and exhibits attached to the text span 4,000 pages. The presidency of South Africa says, and I'm quoting, the evidence will show that undergirding Israel's genocidal acts is the special intent to commit genocide, a failure by Israel to prevent incitement to prevent genocide itself, and its failure to punish those inciting and committing acts of genocide. To go back to the Middle East Eye article, while it's very important and interesting and encouraging to see the South African government taking this line of action, the Middle East Eye article remind us that despite this, South Africa's relationship with Israel is marked with contradictions. The article explained in 2018, South Africa downgraded its embassy to Israel to a liaison office. However, trade between the two countries continues to grow, with South Africa providing Israel with coal for much of its energy needs. Following Colombia's decision to halt the sale of coal to Israel, South Africa is now the second largest supplier of coal to Israel. South African activist Suraya Dadu wrote in a recent opinion article in the Africa Report, and I'm quoting, South Africa may be powering the Israeli war machine that it has accused of genocide and undermining the very judgment they found in its favor. The second article for today is from rabble.ca, Canada's hypocrisy on rule of law shows as Rohingya marks 7th Genocide Remembrance Day. This article was written by Farid Khan and Rais Tinmug back in August. The article explained the long tradition of Canadians to do absolutely nothing when genocide is taking place, even in the few times they actually admit a genocide is taking place. The article explains, and I'm quoting, in September 2018, Canada took leadership on the world stage when it became the first country to recognize Myanmar's atrocities against the Rohingya minority in that country as genocide. Canada was thanked by Rohingya around the world for showing leadership, and there was hope that the federal Liberal government of Justin Trudeau would play a leading role on the world stage to help prevent further genocidal atrocities against the minority. But the article explains that 7 years later, Canada, quote, has not only demonstrated hypocrisy around its frequent claims to being a rule of law nation and a defender of international human rights, it has also demonstrated its abject failure to defend those rights by doing little of substance to address any of the underlying issues around the Rohingya genocide, despite promises to do so on multiple occasions since 2017. Despite past calls by Rohingya activists and Canadian human rights organizations for Canada to file a case against Myanmar at the International Court of Justice, it was the tiny African nation of Gambia that stepped up and took leadership on the issue. Since then, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister has issued media statements on three separate occasions saying it would support Gambia's case, but has failed to follow through each time. To Canadian Rohingya activists, it appears that this nation's leaders are more interested in getting good PR on the international stage than helping to persecute Myanmar for its genocidal crimes, unquote. The article mentioned the situation with the Rohingya minority in Myanmar as a way to make a wider or more important point about Canada. This situation about the Rohingya minority in Myanmar, it's not an exception. Canada has a long history of being inactive and doing absolutely nothing when there's a genocide going on. The article explains, again, and I'm quoting, "Canada's disinterest in preventing or stopping genocide has become very evident over the years with its unwillingness to take action against China and the genocide of its Uyghur minority, its failure to take action or at minimum condemn the genocide of Palestinians by Israel, as well as Canada's failure in the 1990s to do anything to help prevent the Rwandan genocide or the genocide of Muslims in the Balkans. Judging from the inaction of Canadian leaders, it seems Canada is more interested in showing humanity and expressing sympathy for genocide victims after the fact than preventing or stopping crimes from taking place." Unquote. We know for sure Canada at one point will apologize for the stance it's taken today, for its support for apartheid. But by then, what's done is done. And we know these sort of performative apologies will serve no purpose but to appease our guilty conscience.
We Israelis are calling for global pressure on Israel to force an immediate ceasefire. That's the headline of an open letter signed by more than 3,000 Israelis, along with our next guest, the Israeli political scientist Niamh Gordon. The letter concludes by noting, "The leaders of many countries make repeated statements about the horror they feel and verbally denounce Israel's operations, but these condemnations are not backed by practical actions. We're replete with empty words and declarations. Please, for our futures and the futures of all the residents of Israel and the region, save us from ourselves and use real pressure on Israel for an immediate ceasefire," the letter says. For more, we go to London. We're joined by Niamh Gordon, professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. His recent Al Jazeera article is headlined, "Israel's Taken Human Shields to a Whole New Criminal Level." He's co-author of Human Shields, A History of People in the Line of Fire, and co-editor of Torture, Human Rights, Medical Ethics, and the Case of Israel. Niamh Gordon, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off actually by talking about what this letter says and the number of people is the last time we looked, it was 2,000 Israelis who've signed it. Now it's over 3,000. Professor Gordon.
There's a feeling among Israelis that the change cannot come from within. We do not have enough power from within to change the course of actions that Netanyahu and his government have put in place. And the only way to stop the violence, to stop the genocidal violence in Gaza, to stop the violence in Lebanon, and to stop future attacks and geopolitical war in the region is that leaders in Europe and leaders in North America, particularly the United States, put their leg down and say enough is enough and threaten Israel that if there is no ceasefire, they will sanction Israel, they will stop arms trade with Israel, they'll stop sending Israel money, and ultimately stop trading with Israel. So our belief is to save the populations that inhabit this region, we need such an action.
Professor Gordon, does Netanyahu have a plan for Gaza? And what about these negotiations that are now taking place in Doha, in Qatar? Apparently, Egypt has proposed a two-day ceasefire, release of four hostages. What is happening there, and what do you think needs to happen?
Well, I'd like to say a few words about the bigger picture. I think Netanyahu, pre-October 7th, 2023, saw himself as a figure of history, one that has led Israel to economic success, one that will normalize relations with Arab countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia, and one that has slowly managing to erase the Palestinians from history. Come October 7th and the failure of the Israeli intelligence, and after 35 weeks of the protest against the judicial overhaul and the death of 1,200 Israelis and 250 Israeli hostages, he understood that his position in history has changed, and he's trying to rebuild that through, I think, three axes. One is the Gaza Strip, and I have very little belief in the current negotiations. I think large parts of his coalition want to resettle the northern Gaza Strip, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing there and what your previous guest told us about, the kind of displacement of the population there, the destruction of the whole infrastructure of existence of the population through the destruction of the hospitals, of the schools, of the mosques, etc. And ultimately, what Netanyahu's coalition would like is to resettle that part of the Gaza Strip and close the rest of the Palestinians in the south, and probably maintain some kind of ethnic policing there for years to come. In Lebanon, I think Netanyahu would like to cleanse the area that's south of the Litani River from any presence of Hezbollah, and I think that's going to last for quite a while now. I hope I'm wrong, but I think that it's not going to end soon. But I think that the crown of the jewel for Netanyahu, and the only way that he thinks of himself as returning to history as a hero, is through the bombing of the nuclear plants in Iran. I think everything is leading in that direction. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but I think now Netanyahu will wait for the elections on November 5th, and then he'll decide how to continue on that strategy. So I think the talks now in Doha are more of a cosmetic to a large process that we see unfolding now in Israel and the Middle East.
And your response to the grassroots protests across the country of the Biden administration continuing to support Israel?
There's a major gap, both in the United States, but all across Europe and North America, between civil society and the political and financial elites. The civil society has been saying now for over a year, enough, we want ceasefire, we're against this human catastrophe, we're against what Israel's doing to the Palestinian people, we want the Palestinian people to enjoy self-determination, to enjoy statehood like everyone else. And yet the political and financial elites are continuing as if nothing is happening, supporting Israel. Here and there, there's a kind of criticism from Biden, and yet Netanyahu is doing exactly as he wants to do, and the Biden administration is not doing anything. And there's fear from donors here during an election campaign. It's a very complex system, but what we see is this major gap between the two kind of poles, the civil society pole on the one hand and the ruling political and financial elites. And I think we just need to continue doing what we do until we get them to follow their own laws as they appear, for example, in the Memorandum of Arms Trade.
Neve Gordon, I want to thank you for being with us. Israeli political scientist, professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London, is one of the main signatories of the letter that has now more than 3,000 signatories of Israelis calling on international pressure on Israel.
The third article we're gonna focus on is written by Noam Peleg, published on Mondo Vice, and titled "Australia is Dismantling Academic Freedom in Defense of Zionism." Noam Peleg is a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Law and Justice at University of New South Wales in Sydney. The article starts by saying, and I'm quoting, "Over the last year, Australian universities have been subject to a Zionist political pressure campaign for their varied responses to ongoing university student protests against Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. This culminated recently in the Australian Senate with calls to investigate universities for anti-Semitism." The article explains the background and how this escalated to what is going on today. It explains, and I'm quoting, "For a number of years now, Zionist groups have been pressuring universities to adapt the IRA definition against calls from academic student groups and the National Tertiary Education Union to reject it. Indeed, university presidents and administration, with some exceptions, learned a bitter lesson from the experience of the United Kingdom and elsewhere about the threat that the IRA definition poses to academic freedom and freedom of speech on campuses. And so, while in the UK 75% of the universities adopted the definition, following a threat by the Secretary of State for Education to withhold funding from universities, only 5 out of 37 universities in Australia adopted the IRA definition to date." Now, just a reminder, the IRA definition is a very controversial, problematic definition. It's supposed to define what anti-Semitism is. The problem with it is that the critics of this definition says that the goal of the definition is more to prevent any criticism of the Israeli government and not really to prevent actual situation and actual instances of anti-Semitism. So it is often used as a tool of intimidation and silencing of voices of dissent criticizing the actions and the crimes of the Israeli government against Palestinians. The article continues and explains how things started to escalate after October 7. It says, and I'm quoting, "Zionist groups, politicians, and the media created a moral panic about rising anti-Semitism in the community and described universities, and especially the 11 student encampments that were established across Australia, as incubators for anti-Jewish racism. The language of safety was weaponized to amplify their claim about the need to censor pro-Palestine and anti-genocide activities. Realizing that the universities do not meet all their demands, Zionist groups have turned to the political route. In July 2024, the Labour government caved to pressure and appointed a special envoy on anti-Semitism, who is a staunch Zionist. In one of her first public speeches after assuming this role, she listed examples of what she considers to be systemic forms of anti-Semitism. These included posters, graffitis, and boycott Israel stickers, signs that says Israel is genocidal, teaching Israel-Palestine in indigenous studies, and simply wearing a keffiyeh. On top of that, Australia is now also looking into introducing legislation to establish a national student ombudsman to combat anti-Semitism at universities. Henry Reynolds, an Australian historian, commented on that decision by saying, and I'm quoting, "The minister seems to be unaware of what he's proposing, which is the appointment of a government official to act as a political censor inside the universities to control what can be said or promoted." Unquote. The situation in Australia, at least on the political side, is not ending here. This mobilization on a political level has reached the Senate, where a new Senate process asked the public to make submissions of examples of anti-Semitism they see, and also held two public hearings on the topic in September 2024. The article explains, the submission process was marred by the actions of two Zionist lobby groups. They encouraged individuals to spam the commission with submissions by circulating templates and providing an how-to-complain guide that includes dubious examples of anti-Semitism, such as the display of pro-Palestine posters on campuses. Zionist submissions were rife with anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim rhetoric and racism. They targeted Palestinians, racialized communities like Arabs, Muslims, people of color, and anti-Zionist Jews who were labeled as, quote, token Jews and fringe Jewish individuals and groups and Nazi collaborators. Some of these examples of so-called anti-Semitism included, and I'm quoting, solidarity encampment with Palestine, seeing someone wearing a keffiyeh, passing by stickers and flyers with the Palestinian flag on it, walking by a banner saying that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, seeing posters announcing pro-Palestine rallies, invitation to student unions meeting where BDS motions are debated, class discussions about the genocide in Gaza or about settler colonialism in Palestine. One submission even claimed that setting an exam question in an international law course, which mentions that the office of the ICC prosecutor requested arrest warrants against Israel's prime minister and minister of defense, also that was seen as anti-Semitic. Apparently, didn't go better at the Senate level either. The Senate hearings themselves seems to be as problematic as the submissions. The article continues to explain. The first day of hearing included one witness, and that was the special envoy on anti-Semitism. The second day had a program stacked towards Zionist representation, in a move that problematically homogenized Australian Jewish communities and inaccurately conflated Judaism and Zionism. Senators acted as cheerleaders of the Zionist organization while attacking dissent. When it was time to hear from the Jewish Council of Australia, the tone changed. The Jewish Council was established in opposition to Zionist groups, explicitly rejecting the assertion that Jews and Zionism and the State of Israel are the same, or that all Jewish people support the actions of Israel. The senators displayed immense hostility to the representative of the council and questioned their legitimacy. The article explains that this problematic behavior were done by senators from both sides of the political aisle. Zionists are pursuing these extreme measures because they are losing the battle on campuses. In recent months, we saw BDS resolutions adopted in overwhelming majority by students' bodies across the country and trade unions at four major universities: the University of Sydney, the University of New South Wales, the University of Melbourne, and the University of Technology Sydney. In early October, the National Council of the NTEU, which is the Union for Higher Education Staff in Australia, adopted again with an overwhelming majority a BDS motion and a call for an academic boycott of Israel. Unquote. Let's move on now to Lebanon and see the latest crimes that the Israeli invasion has committed and ask, can Lebanese put any hope in the French government's promises?
In Lebanon, where Israel continues to bombard the southern suburbs of Beirut, health officials report Israel carried out at least 17 strikes overnight, leveling numerous buildings, including the offices of Al-Mayadeen, a Lebanese news station. Lebanon's national news agency described last night's attacks as the most violent in the area in recent weeks. Israel also killed three Lebanese soldiers in a strike in the southern part of the country. Israel continues to defy international calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon. This comes as French President Emmanuel Macron hosted an aid conference for Lebanon in Paris. Macron reiterated his call for a ceasefire and vowed to send over $100 million in humanitarian aid to Lebanon.
We go now to Beirut, Lebanon, where we're joined by Rima Majid. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Beirut. Thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about what's happening in one of the oldest cities in the world, entire in southern Lebanon.
Yes, thank you so much, Amy, for having me on the show again. What was happening yesterday was very, very disheartening, but it's really a crime of a global scale. Tyre is a very central city in terms of archaeology, of history, this has been the second city. So Tyre is a city that is in the south and that is, inhabited by a large population. This is the second city in the south, large city in the south, that is being destructed in a systematic way. Yesterday, what we've reports say that the old ruins of Tyre have been hit by strikes. We have seen similar reports from other archaeological and historical sites, such as Baalbek, before. These are ruins that have survived thousands of years and that are being now destroyed by Israel. Unfortunately, we're not seeing the same alarm that we saw when other ruins, whether in Syria or Iraq, were targeted. And I think this is a very important issue to flag and to talk about.
So, Rima Majid, can you say why you think these attacks on these ruins have not received the kind of attention they should? Has UNESCO, for example, at least made a comment?
Yeah, I think the whole war on Lebanon is not receiving the attention that it needs to receive. I mean, there is a full-blown war that is taking very little space in the global media for several reasons. One of them is, unfortunately, wars in this part of the world has become material for consumption, and there's maybe a media fatigue, but also there's an impunity that Israel has been enjoying since a long time, but that has become very flagrant since last year, where at this point what we cover is, survival and bare life. There's so much to cover in terms of people, forced expulsions, people dying, that talking about ruins and history and archaeology is maybe seen not as a priority, but it's a devastating conflict or it's a devastating war that is destroying all sorts of life and on this land, whether social life or even when we think about history.
Rima Majid, if you could respond to what we said earlier, which is that France has pledged over 100 million euros in support, humanitarian aid support to Lebanon, and in particular also comment on what the defense minister, the French defense minister, Sébastien Lecornu, said earlier this week on Monday, that quote, and this is a quote from him, our position, that is to say France's position, right now is primarily driven by the fear of an imminent civil war in Lebanon.
Sure. So on the question of humanitarian aid, I mean, France has just pledged today in the same conference in Paris. The UAE has also pledged, and I'm sure other countries will pledge money. Unfortunately, I mean, this is the hypocrisy of this global system. We've gotten to this point where humanitarianism has become really dehumanizing. The same countries that are sending, I mean, many of those countries that are sending us humanitarian aid are at the same time selling arms and sending arms to Israel to kill us. And the profit they make out of the arms industry is way bigger than what we get in terms of humanitarian aid. made. So in that sense, it's become really dehumanizing that we're turned into objects of humanitarian support that targets, again, just bare life. I mean, the aim now is for people to survive, to have shelter, even if it's not decent shelter, and, you know, just the basics of survival. We don't talk about social lives that have been disrupted, about, dreams that are gone, about plans that are now up in the air, about families that have been, that have lost loved ones or been displaced. So I think this is way bigger than anything humanitarian aid can solve. We saw last week when President Macron tried to insinuate that France should consider an arms embargo on Israel. I mean, we saw the backlash from Netanyahu and others. So I think at this point, to me, this is really hypocritical. On the second point of the comment on a possible civil war in Lebanon, there's a lot of talk inside the country and outside, of course, about the possibility of sliding into a war, social tensions that are increasing because of the effects of displacement and tension in different neighborhoods. Lebanon is already a sectarianized country where, these boundaries can shift quickly and can, become very tense. But the point we don't talk about is that civil wars are not the result of social tension. I mean, we never slip into a civil war. Wars, whether civil or not, are political decisions. And therefore, the question today is, who is going to fund? I mean, yes, I'm not saying a war is impossible. Actually, it is very possible, a civil war. But the question is, who's going to fund it? Who's going to back it politically at the regional level and at the international level? Who's going to send arms? These are the questions that we need to answer, rather than thinking that there's that wars are social explosions. They're not. Revolutions are social explosions.
Earlier this week, at least 13 people, including a child, were killed and about 60 others injured in Israeli airstrike near the Rafik Hariri University Hospital, Lebanon's largest public medical center. At least 32 others were wounded in the attack, which caused major damage to the hospital. Separately, 50 medical workers and 15 patients were forced to evacuate from the Al-Sahel Hospital in southern Beirut Monday after Israel's military claimed without evidence its home to a secret underground Hezbollah bunker containing hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and gold. Doctors insisted there's nothing hidden beneath the hospital and took reporters on a tour of its lower floors to disprove the claims. This is Alex Rossi, international correspondent for Sky News.
This is the Al-Sahel Hospital on the outskirts of Dahir. Dahir, of course, is a stronghold of Hezbollah. Now, we're in the basement. This is, it's alleged by the Israelis that this hospital is being used by Hezbollah as a way of storing gold and cash. Now, we've been invited in here. This tour has been in no way exhaustive. You can see there are lots of other press here as well. But we haven't been controlled in terms of what we can film or where we can point our camera. We've been allowed to open doors, move around. Now, there may be other areas of the hospital that we've not been taken to, but for all, this looks like a hospital.
That's Alex Rossi, again, international correspondent for Sky News. If you could respond, Rima Majed, to what happened there, and also talk about the U.S. State Department once again shoring up Israel and what it's doing. The spokesperson, Matt Miller, saying we've seen footage that's emerged over the course of the past 2 weeks of rockets and other military weapons held in civilian homes. So Israel does have a right to go after those legitimate targets.
Yes, I mean, the targeting of the Hariri Hospital was also very personal to me, because this is exactly where I grew up, actually. This is the neighborhood where I lived for several years. And it targeted civilians, mainly. All the other attacks are also targeting civilians. And this logic of, whether the German foreign minister's logic of Israel having the right to target civilians, and now there's a new logic of the right to target gold and money as a terrorist threat— is completely absurd. I mean, would this apply to Israel? Does Lebanon have the right to defend itself the way, using the same techniques and tactics that Israel uses? Of course not. I mean, this goes against every logic of protection of human rights, but also, I mean, just protection of, this protection of civilians is basic here. So I think what we're seeing is a complete degeneration into a war that has no rules, that respects no international conventions, and there's one side in this war that has complete impunity. We've seen this over the past year, and it's continuing. Israel is targeting civilians. This is just terrorism, this is what it should be called.
And Rima Majid, if you could talk about the attacks, in fact, on financial associations, the branches of a financial association reportedly linked to Hezbollah earlier this week, in fact, on Sunday. What is the Al-Qarz Al-Hassan Association, and why was it hit?
I mean, it's one of the financial institutions that are believed to be controlled by Hezbollah. It follows the same logic of, the neoliberal turn of, giving microfinance. So this is not an aid institution. This is a bank that gives microfinance facilities. What we have been seeing is that Israel is moving from the decapitation, which is continuing, of leaders, but there's also very clear targeting of Hezbollah's social institutions, whether hospitals, schools, banks, etc. So the aim is probably to dismantle, the target is not just Hezbollah as an organization, but it's also, its constituency, its people. And when I say its people or its constituencies, it doesn't mean that these are Hezbollah fighters or members. These are just Lebanese civilians who have a political opinion that happens to be in support of that party. If we apply the logic on any other party, it would sound horrendous. The fact that we are justifying, hearing the German foreign minister, who then, after saying what she said about justifying the right of Israel to kill civilians, then visiting Beirut, is really, I mean, the word today feels like the turn of the 20th century, I mean, the dark years of fascism. It's very alarming that this is how we're dealing with these wars, and this is the logic with which we're justifying the killing of some, but of course not others.
The fourth and final article that we will cover on today's show is titled "Arab States Are Coming Together to Prevent a Regional War. Will the US Listen?" This was published on Mondovice by Mitchell Plutnik. It was published on October 11, so a little bit before the latest Israeli strikes on Iran. The article starts by saying, and I'm quoting, "In a welcome but underreported development last week, Arab states from the Gulf Cooperation Council reportedly sought to reassure Iran of their neutrality in the brewing conflict between Iran and Israel. The stance was expressed by Arab ministers to their Iranian counterparts at a meeting last week in Doha. Initially, reports said that the Gulf states had explicitly stated that they would forbid the United States from using their air bases to attack Iran. This was expressed privately, though reported publicly, and it was verbal, not written, so it doesn't carry the full weight of a formal commitment. Still, the promise is significant, particularly in light of the total inaction beyond empty rhetoric from the Arab leadership since the Israeli genocide in Gaza began. The article continues to explain the U.S. perspective in the region. And it says, and I'm quoting, "Although the United States has enabled Israeli crimes for decades, there was usually some effort to draw a line when Israeli action posed too grave a threat to regional stability or American interests. But Joe Biden has completely abandoned such efforts. There are many reasons for this, including Biden's deeply held and self-declared Zionism, his utter and inhumane disregard for Palestinian lives, and his general weakness as a leader. Another factor, too rarely discussed in the media but very significant, has been the absence of pressure from the Arab leadership. As the analyst Mu'in Rabbani has often pointed out, Arab leaders, particularly the Saudis, have often in the past pushed American presidents to rein Israel in when Israeli actions were making matters too difficult for them, potentially straining U.S.-Arab relations. The article continues to explain why this new promise by the Gulf states to Iran is important. The fact that these reassurances to Iran were made public is a much clearer signal to the White House that the Gulf states do not want to see Israel and the United States start a regional war. More than that, they are also a signal that the relationship with the US is suffering a serious blow right now. Arab states have every interest in regional stability, regardless of their concerns about Iran. And this is a concern that Washington and Israel have severely underestimated. The writer continues to explain that when Arab states actually take a stance, it can make a difference. The power of Arab states standing firm on these matters should not be taken lightly. When a US-allied Arab state takes a firm stand, it has a visible impact. Consider, for example, Egypt. In the midst of the Gaza genocide, Israel was pursuing a strategy of forcing the people of Gaza south, hoping that the buildup of people would force a substantial number to flee into the Sinai Peninsula and become Egypt's problem. Egypt was worried they might not be able to stop Israel's plan. At first, they tried to voice their strong objections through public statements and by communicating directly to Israel and to Washington that this would not be tolerated. Ultimately, Egypt warned the US and Israel that if Israel persisted in pursuing this plan, it would endanger the Camp David Accords. Israel backed off. It's remarkable what a threat can do when you actually mean it. The article continues to explain that while Arab states can and have the tools to put pressure, they often don't. A good example is the UAE. The writer explains, and I'm quoting, "The United Arab Emirates could do the same with the Abraham Accords. They could have used the threat of withdrawing from the Abraham Accords to pressure Israel to curb its genocide in Gaza. Biden has been desperate to expand the Accords and has failed to do so. If they had been reversed under his watch, it would have been a huge blow to him. Maybe it would have worked, maybe it would not have. We'll never know because the UAE never even considered trying. By the same token, Saudi Arabia could also have done a lot more to push the Biden administration." The article then explains where are we seeing signals of a potential shift with the attitude of Saudi Arabia that has been so far absent. It says, and I'm quoting, "Their foreign minister, Faisal bin Farhan Saud, published an op-ed in the Financial Times last week that represented the strongest statement by far from the kingdom since October 7. He called a Palestinian state a prerequisite for peace and explicitly stated that self-defense was not motivating Israel's actions. He even called for a real accountability for Israel. The statement was bolstered by the visit of Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi to Riyadh, a sign of the growing rapprochement between the two countries. While many tensions remain between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it is clear that the Saudis no longer trust the United States to maintain security in the region and are working with Iran to de-escalate the current tensions and address the long-term ones." Now, it's important to remember that whatever stance any of these governments takes, it's usually has to do with their own personal interest and not necessarily because there's any care for human rights of Palestinians or any other civilians. The writer reminds us, With Biden's and Netanyahu's genocide now a full year old, the horrific crimes against the Palestinians that is being committed is clearly not a moral issue for Western or Arab leaders. Yet, one would think perceived national interest might come into play at some point for Washington, as it now has for the Saudis and the Emiratis. The article next explains why Iran is a bit different, why Israel can defy United States when it comes to Palestine and Lebanon, but when it comes to Iran, it's a little bit more tricky for Benjamin Netanyahu to go full-on attack on the country without the US support. If the US ever did object to Israel's behavior, Benjamin Netanyahu can't thumb its nose at Biden in Gaza, and even to an extent in Lebanon, because these places are either under Israeli occupation or right on its borders. Even if offensive weapons stopped flowing tomorrow, Israel has enough firepower to continue those attacks for a while. But Iran is a very different proposition. Israel can pull off targeted assassinations and some missile or drone attacks, but to really attack Iran, they need the United States. The fact that Israel has taken this long to strike Iran is likely an indication that they are trying to find a response that the US will support, meaning that they are thinking about a big strike that will hurt Iran and are trying to find one that the United States will not only tolerate, but will help with, at least with intelligence and logistics. Saudi and Emirati resistance to a strike on Iran should be good news, and it is for anyone who genuinely wants to see peace in the Middle East. But the Biden administration's hawks are seeing their plans frustrated by the Saudi and Emirati effort to stave off a regional war. That's it for us for today. We covered several news from various countries, from South Africa to Canada, Israel, Australia, Lebanon, France, and the Gulf countries, especially Saudi Arabia. If you missed part of the show, you can listen to it again on our page on CQUT's website, cqut.ca. Just click on the name of the show and you will find all the recordings of previous episodes. I was your host, Sausan Kadura, and you were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
The second Friday nights in the Recital Hall concert will be Cassador on November 22nd at 8 p.m. These shows at the Isabel are licensed in all ages and tickets sell out fast. Get yours today. Check out queensu.ca/theisabel for details. It speaks to me. The words
she gives me, they're all empty.
Your morning.